Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
This is Radio City Talk.
Okay, so Mental Health Monday this week features a couple of guests here in the studio who are going to be talking about a really important thing. Now, there is something which is going to be happening. We'll be telling you about as part of next week's show, which we will skirt around a little bit today. But that's just a little bit of a teaser, something which is going to be pretty big because my two guests in the studio have got a really important event to head to later on in the week. We won't say too much about it, but we will talk about suicide in particular. There is plenty of stats and facts around this one. We talk about it a lot on Mental Health Monday. The figures, the numbers of people whose lives are lost because of suicide, more than 6,000 in any particular year. And obviously we've talked as well on the programme before about whether or not sometimes men versus women, the numbers very much skewed towards men as well, to the tune of something like 75%. But how do we talk about these things? Let's find out now. Very pleased to say we've got with us in the studio, Jane Boland. Now, Jane is from Merseycare and she is the suicide prevention lead. Jane, it's great to see you. Thank you for your time.
Hello.
And Angela Samata, who is a regular contributor to the programme as well. She lost her husband to suicide. Angela, thank you for your time too. Really appreciate you coming on the programme.
Thank you.
Jane, suicide. You know, when we talk about taboos in society, suicide is very, very much up there, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's probably the last one. It's the one that people are scared to talk about. It's how people used to talk about cancer and other forms of illness sort of 15, 20 years ago. But yes, it is, yeah.
It's something that you've worked in, and you've worked in the mental health field for a number of years. Just tell us a little bit about sort of your journey, if you like.
Well, I've been working in pretty much sort of frontline mental health services for nearly 20 years. I qualified and started working with Merseycare as an occupational therapist in 2001. And have always worked in mental health and always worked sort of at the front of mental health, either in inpatient units or working with crisis teams or A&E teams. And when I started 20 years ago, for clinicians, for professionals, it was a scary sort of subject. We would skirt around. We would use the language that we're trying to get people not to use. You know, we would talk about all. You know, we would be scared to ask. We were scared that asking somebody directly about suicide would make it more likely for them to do it. Happily, we know that it's the exact opposite. But that's a hard lesson that we've learned over the last 20 years, and that's been very much part of my clinical journey, sort of starting as a newly sort of trained sort of mental health professional. My training as an occupational therapist taught me about how to support people, how to help people recover, but it didn't tell me how to talk to somebody who just tried to kill themselves, and I had to learn on the job.
It's we always draw the comparison between physical and mental health, the equivalent of working if you were in an A&E department and being afraid to ask if someone had been in a car crash, you know, or being afraid to sort of, you know, ask why they had a broken leg.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like that. And it almost seems, and you know, everyone's on a journey when they it comes to sort of opening up about their own mental health as well. Have you seen that as a natural progression, or have you seen times where things have changed, or maybe it's training that you've been involved in, maybe it's events which have been sort of out of your hands?
I mean, for me, it was being able to do some very specific training and started. I mean, in Merseycare, which was where I was working at the time, we started started a crisis resolution and home treatment team, I think, in 2006, and I was one of the practitioners who was part of that brand new team when it started. And we had some very specific training that helped us to think about how we would have that conversation, because as clinicians, you're looking for an assurance almost that the person isn't going to hurt themselves when they leave you. So when you're working in A&E or if you're working in someone's home, you want to feel that somehow you can leave that person and they won't hurt themselves in the time between you leaving and you coming back to see them again. And I think sometimes we would look for a false reassurance from that person. And I think the journey that we've taken is an understanding that suicidal thoughts and suicidal intent come and go. And what we need to support people to, you know, support service users, support anyone to develop is the ability to manage those thoughts when they come back. So, you know, it's not, you know, on Monday at 11 o'clock, you're suicidal, and at 11:30, you're not, and I can send you home. It's, you know, what can we do so that if that happens again, if those thoughts come back, how will you cope with them next time? And I think that's the difference in practice that people are experiencing and people are delivering as clinicians now.
So that sort of that epiphany or that moment where you kind of accept that as the new way of thinking about things. How does that then change the way you would deal to somebody on a day-to-day basis? How would that improve the service maybe that you're able to offer?
I think it moves away from thinking that you can stop a risk from happening to moving that you are empowering and working with somebody and their families and the people around them to think about how they can manage those thoughts and feelings when, because they will come back. For most people, it's not an if, it's a when. So when they come back, the next time that this happens to you and you have these thoughts, you think that ending your life is the best option for you, what can you do? How can you remind yourself about what's available to you? How can you access help? Some of that help might be that you need to get emergency help, but some of it might be that you know that there are things that you can do. And, you know, some of those will be quite straightforward things like, you know, going outside and getting some fresh air, doing something that you enjoy, talking to somebody who you trust. You know, how can you make sure that you can do those if you start to feel those thoughts and feelings coming back?
In terms of your experience as well, we make so much of the 18 to 35 male category in particular. Is there, when you talk about frontline and crisis teams, is there an individual that you have in mind at that point? You know, you must speak to many different people from many different walks of life. You have many different experiences. But is there a typical case, or is there a template that keeps coming your way of people who find themselves in similar situations who are from similar backgrounds?
The statistics tell us that actually it's middle-aged men who are quite isolated and dislocated from family support who are sort of probably the highest risk group that are out there. But these suicidal thoughts, the actions that people take, people hurting themselves, that can happen to anyone. So there isn't a typical person, but I think there are typical things that people might be going through which lead them to feel suicidal. So it can often be related to people experiencing some sort of loss. So a loss of a job, a loss of a relationship, a loss of a role. It can be related to people feeling that they're not really worth helping, that they're feeling that they're a burden on people, that they're not worth, they're not connected to anyone, quite isolated. So the typical person, I couldn't tell you, but the typical feeling.
I was going to ask you about that word isolation and whether or not that was something which came through as a theme. And I wonder whether or not, you know, part of the thing that people are trying to get now is that, you know, we want to be talking about it, we want to be open about it, but there's a real sense of many of the people that I speak to, there was a sense of isolation, that the problems were my own problems, that the issues were my own issues. Did you tell anyone? No, of course I didn't, because I didn't want to burden them with the feelings that I was having, for instance. Is isolation one of the key themes, do you think?
Yeah, and you know, it's isolation, it can be isolation within a family, within a loving family, you know, within a family that would do anything to help you if they knew that was what you were feeling. So, you know, for some people it is that they don't have anybody, that they're in a situation where they really struggle to think who they would talk about. But the, you know, people who have spoken to me about feeling suicidal talk about feeling very ashamed of how they feel. You know, they feel that they're a burden. They feel very guilty about expressing those thoughts and feelings. And as somebody, you know, as a family member, to hear somebody that you love say those words is very challenging. And I suppose it's trying to support people to understand that, you know, somebody you love tells you that they're feeling suicidal. It's not because you're a bad girlfriend or a bad mum. You know, at that point, it's not about you. It's about how they feel, and that feeling of worthlessness is so sort of debilitating that it's hard for the person to even express it. Being given permission to, being allowed to talk about it, just takes the heat out of the whole situation. And you can start, you know, once that kind of box has been opened, it's all, you know, people talk about feeling like it's a relief, it's a release. And once you've kind of, you know, you've got your frying pan and you've taken it off the heat, you can start thinking about how to solve some of the problems. Because often the problems that somebody's facing are eminently solvable. You know, they're often related to financial problems or to sort of social problems that have a solution. But in that state of mind, people have really struggled to see what it could be.
I know mental health is now a thing that people talk about, capital M, capital H, mental health. But I heard somebody say on the radio just the other day, a problem shared is a problem halved. And I thought, well, actually, that's a centuries old thing that, yeah, that people would say. But actually, it's based around that idea of, are you struggling with something? Tell somebody about it. And it's one of those phrases, a stock phrase that people actually have. But when you think about it, there are serious serious implications for what it could actually mean.
The training that I did back in 2006 talked about sort of suicide and how people get to the stage where they have decided that suicide is the best option, that the end of their life would solve the problems that they've identified, and being able to sort of say, you know, well, okay, I guess I understand that that's one solution. How about we think about some other ones? You know, can we shelve that for a couple of hours whilst we try and work out what else can happen today that might start things changing? And it's effective. That's the approach that people will experience if they talk to clinicians in when they're in that type of crisis. And it sounds quite simplistic, but it is about saying, you know, we probably can't solve all your problems today, but there may be solutions for them. And if you can just hold that solution that you've got, which is to kill yourself for a while, let's see how we're feeling tomorrow, yeah, if we can do these things, or let's see how we're feeling in 2 hours, or let's see how we're feeling in 10 minutes, if that's, you know.
And in terms of that, I mean, can I ask you, and forgive me if this is an awful question, but, you know, if you were a surgeon, you would do surgery, and, you know, some people would survive, other people would, you know, respond to treatment, other people would not. What's that like for you in terms of the work that you've done and the people that you're working with, where sometimes you put that training into practice?
Yeah.
You do your best to provide those alternatives to try and make somebody think differently or put them on a path to a different thing, and it doesn't go according to plan. Is that a disheartening thing? Is that just an upsetting thing? Or is that something which you almost have to learn from in each individual case?
It's all of those. I'm sure I could speak confidently for anybody who has been involved in this sort of provision of mental health care. When you are in a situation where somebody that you've been involved in their care and treatment ends their life by suicide, it's very upsetting. You question yourself as a clinician. You think about, was there anything? Did you miss something? Did you get something wrong? You know, what did you not do that could have prevented it? You do try and learn. You do try and think, well, if this, you know, if somebody spoke to me about that, did I do the right thing? But it is, it's the most challenging part of our practice is that, and it's happened to me. I've been involved in the care of people who've died by suicide, and it's pretty awful.
And does suicide have different stages? Sometimes people think suicide is like a full stop on the end of a sentence, but presumably suicide comes into people's minds. People I've spoken to on this programme have talked about,
yeah,
when suicide first crossed their mind, and then it's something that they consider, think about, and then there's the means and the motive for, and then you hear the case Clark Carlisle was talking on the radio about this just a few weeks ago, about the moment where you decide that that's what you actually want to do. And I wonder whether or not you spot those signs and how far along people are on that particular journey.
That's part of your assessment. So when you sort of are going through an assessment and you're talking to somebody about, you know, my understanding, this is how I would talk to somebody. You know, my understanding is that sometimes when people experience depression, they can have distressing thoughts of ending their life. Is that something that's happened to you? And that person might say, well, yes. So then I would go work through and, you know, is this a thought? If it's a thought, how far have you thought about it? Have you made a plan? If you have a plan, have you got the means together with that, you know, for that plan so that you can carry it out? Do you have them with you? Have you already done it? And it's a gradual process to work with somebody to think about where they might be, and then work with them to think about how you can kind of put a huge big barrier there so that they can't carry on with their plan. And most of the time that barrier is very psychological and very sort of like, you know, using that problem solving approach. Very occasionally the barrier is that the person needs to go somewhere where we can support them to stay safe. So it might be that we would think about that we would need to put sort of, you know, intensive support for the person to stay at home, or occasionally it's that we would ask them to go into hospital, and even more occasionally we might ask somebody to go into hospital and think that they would need to go in whether they wanted to or not, and request that they be assessed under the Mental Health Act. So it's a huge continuum from kind of a, yes, I have thought about it, but it's very fleeting, to I don't know that I could stop myself if those thoughts come back, and I've already thought about how I would do it and I've got a plan in place. So it's a massive continuum, yeah.
We've got Jane Boland with us from Merseycare, suicide prevention lead. We'll bring Angela into the conversation next. It's Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk.
Radio City Talk, tackling the stigma.
It's Mental Health Monday. My name's Mick Coyle. A guest in the studio today, we have Jane Boland, who is suicide prevention lead for Merseycare, and also Angela Samata, who is a mental health campaigner and who lost her husband to suicide. Angela, we were having the conversation with Jane about the work that she does there. Did you hear throughout that conversation maybe echoes of your own story, things that you recognised in terms of the options that are there for people, and the things that people might experience if they're able to get into that path of being talking about suicide?
Yeah, I think as happened with Mark was one of the people who, you know, it's kind of 75% of people who take their lives don't link in with any kind of mental health services or any agencies. And so when I hear Jane talking so eloquently and brilliantly about the conversation that you can have with people who are feeling suicidal and have decided to tell someone that that's the way they feel, then every single time I hear it, put across so brilliantly, it just makes me think that I wish Mark had told somebody how he felt, because he could have been somebody who was sitting in front of Jane having that conversation and thinking about resolving problems and thinking about what had brought him to that state of mind. But unfortunately, he was one of those people who don't tell anybody. And in fact, I was the last person to speak to him about 15 minutes before I found him.
And I guess as well, that feeds into the comments about isolation, that sometimes people are isolated, people who live on their own maybe, don't have any friends, don't have any family ties, don't have somebody who would speak to them, you know, on a phone, you know, 15 minutes before they were due to go ahead with something like that as well. But actually, in your own experience, isolation isn't just, you know, somebody who lives out on their own, you know, on a rock in the middle of the sea.
I mean, I think what I would absolutely echo what Jane said. There's no typical person. You know, when we think about isolation, you know, traditionally we've thought about, you know, somebody living in the house on their own and kind of cooking for one. But that's not what isolation looks like anymore. You can feel isolated. You can feel the most loneliest person in the world when you're in a room of 1,000 people. And I think most of us have probably experienced that. So I think isolation as we think of it now is very, very different than isolation that we may have thought of kind of, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Isolation now is different. And I think because we're living at such an amazing pace, everyone's life looks beautiful on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, you can feel isolated in the biggest crowd. So I think that's something that I've certainly learned over the time that I've worked with Jane, for instance, is that isolation can be a very, very powerful feeling, but actually it can happen to the most seemingly popular people in the world and people who come from a really loving family. Yeah. You know, sometimes it's harder. Someone said to me once, well, if I didn't tell my mum that I had a new boyfriend, why did she think that I was going to tell her that I was feeling suicidal? And it's almost like, you know, I wonder about that with Mark. I wonder whether he wanted to kind of protect us all. In fact, he loved us so much that he didn't want to be a burden. And that burdensomeness is an actual phrase that we use, that people feel as if their life and their family are so good that they almost don't want to kind of break that, you know. And I think that, again, you know, listening to Jane have that conversation, you know, you'd give anything, wouldn't you, for him to be sitting here having that conversation with a clinician like Jane, because it's, yeah, that's the reason why we work together, you know, because she's so amazing at doing that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that isolation, it really strikes me that, because it's one of the themes that always comes up, that people will say, you know, you're isolated, or they'll be, well, you got loads of friends, you got loads of family, and it's that. But I wonder whether or not actually for some people that sense of I'm in a room with lots of people and I should feel different, but actually I feel completely isolated,
absolutely,
makes you think that's more of the problem. Do you feel isolated in a crowded space?
I think one of the overriding sentences that I hear when we've worked with people who have made very serious attempts on their life, one of the overriding things that I hear time and time again is that sentence which starts, I thought that everybody would be better off without me. And it's that feeling, you know, it's that feeling that is very, very difficult to kind of access, that type of thinking, if somebody feels as if they can't be open and honest.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of the things that we are trying to do in Merseycare, and that we've sort of done within our own services, is try to make people think differently about suicide and what it means, and what the act of suicide or the act of a suicide attempt means to the person who's doing it. And when we were sort of 3 years ago thinking about how we could make this kind of the huge amount of sort of clinical research and, you know, I mean, available to the person on the street, was how would we translate, you know, the incredible work that, you know, Professor Appleby and Professor Horton and Professor, you know, have done to improve our understanding. How can we take all that sort of research and make it something that a person sitting with their son or daughter can use and you know, can start a conversation. So we thought about some of the big myths. So one of the myths was, if you talk about suicide, it'll make somebody more likely to do it. And I can say with confidence, based on the research of lots of much cleverer people than me, that we know that that isn't the case. If you talk about it, it makes it less likely. One of the other myths was somehow the idea that the act of suicide is a selfish act, and it's anything but. You know, that person who they are thinking about how much better off the people around them would be if they didn't have to have them in their life. And to be in that desperate place, you know, I've been in A&E and had a young mum sort of talk about how her children are babies and they probably won't remember them. You know, they won't remember her, and this is a good time for her to die because her children won't remember her and they will be better off having someone else look after them. And as a mum myself, you know, it's heartbreaking.
That is heartbreaking, yeah.
To hear the distress that somebody feels so worthless and of so little value to the people that they love, that death, their own death, would make somebody else's life better. And it completely upturns that idea that what the person is doing is a sort of a selfish or an angry or a vengeful act. And when we sort of started doing this in Merseycare and started thinking about how we could get people to think a bit differently, we put that in the training that we developed for our staff. And, you know, we've evaluated it, and the way that we approached it in that training, which was a bit sort of, when I look at it now, looks a bit clunky, but it was just explaining to people that process. You know, when somebody's feeling this distressed, they often feel that they're not worth anything and that you would be better off without them. And again, it's a way of, you know, helping you understand as a mum or as a husband or as a wife, that it's, you know, those feelings aren't about you. They're not they're not about reflecting negatively on your ability to care. It's that the person is feeling so low and so distressed that they feel that somebody'd be better off without them. And if we can get, you know, that message across to people, so that you might hear this come back from somebody that you love, and if you can take that deep breath and continue with the conversation and help them to get to a place where you can get them some help, you know, you you know, you will be saving their life at that point.
And when you talk about, you know, the professors and the papers and everything that's been, is that why it's important to work with people like Angela? So Angela can come on board. The phrase lived experience gets used now, doesn't it, in terms of people who can do that, not just in a clinical way, but in a people way. And Angela always puts it across incredibly, doesn't she, in the way that she talks in very honest and real terms about her own experience.
For me, it has been incredible working with Angela sort of for the last 18 months. Because what has happened for us sort of on our co-production journey is there are areas around suicide prevention that Angela is an expert. You know, she's an expert in thinking about how it might sound. You know, we've sort of worked on developing training for clinicians and for the general public. And, you know, the way that we've worked together, I think, has meant that the training that we've developed, you know, for clinicians that we've tried and we're sort of developing within our own organisation feels much more real, because, you know, it's all about the lived experience of not just Angela, but other people who've shared their lived experience with us and allowed that to be part of the training as well.
I've got a piece of paper which says strictly embargoed, because there's something happening on Thursday which we can't specifically talk about, but we will share as part of next week's Mental Health Monday. Yeah. What can you tell me then, Angela? Because if you say it...
If I say it, I won't get into trouble. I think really Thursday, the big national UK-wide announcement that's going to be made on Thursday is really the culmination of Jane and I kind of working together within Merseycare with lots of different people, with an organisation called Relias who provide kind of training. And what they did was they took what was in our heads and made it beautiful. So that's what's happened on Thursday. So yeah, we can't talk about it. But I think the thing I'd just like to say is that for me, the big shift has been in co-production, and it is about people like Jane being brilliant clinicians, working in the field for a long time, but then allowing people like me as a non-clinician to kind of have a conversation that kind of, you know, we sometimes Jane's the expert, sometimes I'm the expert, sometimes, and learning from that lived experience, I think, is what is making mental health care better and better and better and better. Because it is kind of thinking about it from the service user's point of view, from the clinician point of view, and really it's clinicians like Jane who are kind of, you know, quite selfless and able to kind of come down from the high horse. You know, we used to think of, you know, you'd do anything that a doctor told you, wouldn't you? And sometimes it wasn't always the best thing. But I think that Jane being open and being happy to have the conversation and to really co-produce. Sometimes it's not easy to co-produce when you know, when you're working with some people who think that they are the academic kind of high flyers in their field. Sometimes it's quite difficult as a layperson to come across and say, well, actually, that made me feel really not okay. Is there a way we can talk about that might be more accessible? But again, I think that's the thing that I really enjoy about working with people like Jane, is because we find that meeting place, and it's about really co-producing things. You know, co-production is something we talk about a lot, and people don't always co-produce, they tick boxes, but we actually co-produce and look at everything and kind of work together in, you know, coming from our different ends of the field. So yeah, it's been great. And I think the most important things with working with Jane and what we're trying to do is to really make suicide not an inevitability. You know, it's like when Jane told me the story about, you know, when you know, often it was kind of, if somebody died and it was an inpatient death, somebody was in an inpatient unit, it was kind of, you know, the attitude many years ago was kind of, well, that's your first one out the way, you know, which is just awful, because that's people like me are left behind, you know. And I think it was a coping mechanism within the staff structure that was kind of, well, that's your first one, you know, let's crack on, let's go back. But now it's changing, and I think we're moving away from that inevitability, which is really exciting.
And we're always drawing the conclusion, the comparison similarities between mental health and physical health. But I guess with this, Jane, it's a little bit different, isn't it? Because if you go and, you know, go to the doctor and you've got a broken leg, you get a surgeon, and it's the doctors actually. But with this way of working in the mental health field, it's not just on the doctors actually. You're able to bring in the equivalent of other people who'd previously maybe broken their legs, who can come in and sort of carry some of that weight as well.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, I think Merseycare have sort of been quite brave over the years to sort of be, you know, to to bring in people who've experienced traumatic care. I know my colleagues sort of in the team that I work within Merseycare, which is called the Perfect Care Team, have
no
worked
pressure.
No pressure there, have worked on
much better than the average care
yeah.
team.
But yes, exactly, but that's it, isn't it? You know, would you go to a hospital that said we'll do our best to provide the mean level of care to you, you know, or the average care that you can expect? You know, it's a hugely aspirational goal, but the so some of my colleagues have been working on a program to reduce how the use of restraint in inpatient settings, and again, you know, what really is effective and changes the culture and changes the conversation is hearing from people about what is it like to be restrained? What does it mean to be restrained? Now, most people who have mental health problems don't need to go into hospital. Most people who go into hospital don't need to be detained and put into hospital against their will. And most people in hospital do not experience ever being restrained. But the people who do, it's so distressing and traumatic that you know, it impacts on their care. So by reducing the restraints, you know, and reducing that whole approach, it improves the care for the individual. But, and this is sometimes why we do these things as well, you know, they had incredible results on the wards and the teams that they use this approach with. Things like the reduction of sickness absence amongst the staff, you know, reduction of complaints about the whole ward generally, because it changed the culture. And that's the power of lived experience, trying to imagine what it must be like to have somebody hold you down. Now, it's never, I've noticed, you know, and then thinking about what can I do if somebody's distressed to make that the very, very last option, that is an option that would only ever happen if that person was going to sort of cause themselves very severe harm. And even then, people, you know, it's a much more pragmatic approach to you know, but it's pulling in that lived experience that changes how we think about delivering care.
Thank you for your time today. Really appreciate you coming on the programme. Really appreciate it. If anyone's listening to this, Jane, and they're in that frame of mind at the moment, as sort of the suicide prevention lead for Merseycare, what would you recommend they do at this moment?
At this moment, there are incredible resources available to people. People can phone the Samaritans, and young people can contact a team called an organisation called Papyrus, and they can get emergent, you know, instant support and advice over the phone or by text with Papyrus. If you feel that this is something that's happening to you, you've never asked for help before, the first place to go will be to talk to your GP.
Jane Boland, thank you for your time. Suicide Prevention Lead for Merseycare, Angela Samata, thank you for your time too.
Thank you. And good luck tonight.
Thank
you
very much.
Good luck.
We'll see how we get on. I'll let you know. It's Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
This is Radio City Talk.